Thank you for those kind words, Stan. Ladies and gentlemen, allow me to begin by adding to our day's observations on Elvis Presley. At the time I published The Conservative Mind, the young person who became my wife, Sonetta Vaughn Cecile Corp Monch, was dancing on her front porch in Springfield Gardens to the tunes of Elvis Presley. And my third daughter, Felicia Netkirk, who is now with her back turned toward me at this near table, in her mind, the reputation of her father greatly increased when she learned some months ago that once upon a time I received a Christmas card from Elvis Presley, and that it is somewhere in my archives, and I have promised to her when it can be unearthed. Well, the members who were present this morning are aware that I made the great refusal and insisted upon remaining an undistinguished member of the Philadelphia Society rather than a distinguished member. And the reason for that is that I've just begun to fight, as I said. My previous achievements are slight, but I still aspire to great victories and to write books much more influential than those I've written already. And I'm commencing a new campaign, to which I am accumulating a large park of artillery. And my remarks today may be viewed as the beginning of that campaign. Another volume of my heritage lectures will soon appear, and this will probably be a introduction to or the first installment of a third volume of heritage lectures. At any rate, you'll see the nature of my challenge to present dominations and powers. The wise men know what wicked things are written on the sky. You'll see that I mean to pour my vials of vitriol upon the heads of socialists and to flail with whips of scorpions the libertarians. At the end of the 20th century of the Christian era is not far distant. And all about us, things fall apart. Comes to my mind the last drawing of William Hogarth, the British painter who died in 1764. It is a sufficient representation of the state of civilization in the year 1984. Hogarth's final drawing is known as the Bathos, B-A-T-H-O-S, or Finis, F-I-N-I-S, the end. This word, Bathos, signifies the depths or the bottom. Also, it is applied to the process of sinking from the sublime to the ridiculous. Hogarth's pencil shows us a devastated and desiccated world in which all things have come to an end. In the shadow of a ruined tower, Father Time himself lies expiring, his scythe and his hourglass broken. In the last puff of smoke from Father Time's tobacco pipe, there one discerns the word finis, a cracked bell, a shattered crown, the discarded stock of an old musket, the tottering signpost of a tavern called the World's End, a bow unstrung, a map of the world burning, a gibbet falling, an empty purse, a proclamation of bankruptcy, the stump of a broom, a broken bottle. All this litter lies about fallen Father Time. Overhead, the moon wanes, and Phoebus and his horses lie dead in the clouds. A wrecked ship is seen in the background. What once was sublime has descended to the ridiculous. Thus the world ends, not with a bang, but a whimper. A month after he executed this famous tale piece, William Hogarth himself ceased to be. This is the bent world of Orwell's 1984, and it is the actual state in many lands of what once was a civilized order. Will the wave of the future, perhaps by the end of the century, engulf such surviving pleasant islands as this hotel in which we are deliberating? Are there means for resisting this inundation? Or do we, like Canute, command the tide in vain to retreat from the beach on which we have taken our stand? Most of us reflecting on, now and again, upon our present discontents, are tempted to feel that the present struggle not availeth, that freedom and justice and order in our civilization are trickling away, like sands in Father Time's hourglass. That at best we will become the isolated and powerless individuals of Alexis de Tocqueville's democratic despotism, never permitted wholly to come to man's estate. That would be a society infinitely boring. But the alternative might be ghastly slaughter and starvation of the sort that have already devastated much of Africa, Asia, and Eastern Europe. The naive meteorism of the 18th and 19th centuries has vanished from among us. It has been succeeded by gloomy vaticinations among the old as among the young as among the old. Now, perhaps you fear that I am embarking upon a long tale of woe, but I mean to spare you that. Rather, my purpose today is to suggest that you and I are not the slaves of some impersonal force of the sort that Hegel and Marx called history. For history, after all, is no divine power, but merely a series of written records of what has happened in past times. I come to you not as a gravedigger, but as a diagnostician. Indeed, our whole civilization is sorely afflicted by decadence. Yet it need not follow that, having already passed the point of no return, we need submit ourselves to total servitude and infinite boredom. Just as a renewal of soul and body sometimes is possible for the individual person, so whole societies may recover in considerable part from follies and blunders. Letting some cheerfulness break in, I have taken for the title of this address a line from G.K. Chesterton's long poem, The Ballad of the White Horse, which has for its setting the age of King Alfred in England. In certain stanzas of the first book of that courageous ballad, Chesterton speaks of Eastern fatalism as contrasted with Christian hope. He speaks of those men of the East who spell the stars and times and triumphs mark, those who pretend to prophesy. Here Chesterton has in mind the historical determinists and prophets of doom of the 20th century. I give you two stanzas. The wise men know what wicked things are written on the sky. They trim sad lamps, they touch sad strings, hearing the heavy purple wings where the forgotten seraph kings still plot how God shall die. The wise men know all wicked things under the twisted trees, where the perverse and pleasure pine, and men are weary of green wine and sick of crimson seas. Well, truly many wicked things have been written on the sky of 1984, worse than the things written on New York subway cars. And the perverse and pleasure pine in their millions, glutted with narcotics, pornography, and insane sensuality. A good many people fret themselves over the rather improbable speculation that the Earth itself may be blown asunder by nuclear weapons. The grimmer and more immediate prospect is that men and women may be reduced to a subhuman state through limitless indulgence in their own vices, with ruinous consequences to society generally. The possibilities for efficient corruption, political and personal, are greater in our time than in any previous era. We have devised ingenious instruments to that end. Anyone who thinks seriously upon these tribulations must grow thoroughly disheartened from time to time. He is tempted to confess to himself that he is one of those men of the East who know all too well what wicked things are written on the sky, tempted to shrug, to sigh, and to murmur, what cannot be mended must be endured. If most of the wise, or relatively wise, among us so resign themselves, indeed all is lost. Public affairs that are surrendered to the domination of squalid oligarchies, and private life becomes a fruitless pursuit of sensual pleasure that gypsy witch, Elamar Brujo. One may trace such a process through the Roman decadence, but we of the 20th century have enabled ourselves to carry on the process more swiftly and more thoroughly. Should we then submit ourselves to what is said to be inevitable, to the writing in the sky that fatalists descry? The question entered the mind of Edmund Burke near the end of his tether, when it appeared that Jacobinism was sweeping all before its armed doctrine and soon would engulf Britain. Burke declared that it would be better to die with a sword in hand than to submit to a social life and death. And he pointed out to the British government that what may appear inevitable, the foredoomed course of mankind, actually may be undone or averted by people and events quite unexpected and brought forward by subtle and mysterious forces whose coming the wisest of men could not predict. There is no ineluctable march of history. As Burke wrote in his fourth letter of the Regicide Peace, the death of a man at a critical juncture, his disgrace, his retreat, his disgrace, have brought innumerable calamities on a whole nation, a common soldier, a child, a girl at the door of an inn, have changed the face of fortune and almost of nature. Well, here Burke is referring to historical instances. His man who died at a critical juncture is Pericles. Coriolanus in the early Roman Republic is his instance of disgust. The elder Pitt's retirement from public affairs, a major cause of the American War of Independence, is the retreat he mentions. The disgrace is that of the Constable of Bourbon in the time of Francis I. His common soldier is Arnold of Winkelried, flinging himself upon the foreign lances at Sempach. His child is Hannibal, at the age of 12, taking his oath to make war upon Rome. His girl at the inn is Joan of Arc. History is made by human actions and thoughts, not by irresistible abstract imperatives. And providence ordinarily operates through human agents. The world is ruled by imagination. So we are told by Napoleon Bonaparte, master of the big battalions. In our day, the world is appears to be ruled by what T.S. Eliot called the diabolic imagination. The political imagination of the ferocious ideologue, the obscene imagination of the literary panderer, have brought us to bathos and nearly to finis. The only weapon effective against the diabolic imagination is the moral imagination, a term we owe to Edmund Burke. So let us turn here to a diagnosis of the causes of our afflictions, public and private, and to conceivable remedies. The most mischievous and mover and shaker of the French Revolutionary era was Jean-Jacques Rousseau, a moralist, as Burke acknowledged him to be. The most mischievous mover and shaker of the Russian Revolutionary era was Karl Marx, a moralist of the diabolical variety. As Alexander Gray puts it, to consider whether Marx was right or wrong, to dredge volumes 1 and 2 of Das Kapital for inconsistencies or logical flaws to refute the Marxian system is in the last resort sheer waste of time. For when we consort with Marx, we are no longer in the world of reason or logic. Marx saw visions, clear visions of the passing of all things, much more nebulous visions of how all things may be made new. And his visions, or some of them, woke a responsive chord in the hearts of many men. Just so. It was a principal error of the 19th century rationalists to fancy that most people are moved by enlightened self-interest. Certainly there is sufficient selfishness in all of us, but knowing where one's best interest lies in the long run is another matter. Instead, men are moved by visions of a sort, whether sublime visions or gross visions. How many people choose their spouses on the basis of enlightened self-interest, or have the opportunity to do so, even if they would? In affairs matrimonial, as in affairs public, the visionary imagination's part is much larger than that of either enlightened self-interest or pure reason. And people are moved by moral intentions, even when their intentions are to subvert the conventional morality. How many sincere communists would there be if the avowed purpose of Marx was to slaughter and loot? Communists do slaughter and loot, and Marx approved of at least the slaughter. But these are incidental pleasures. The avowed motive is the redemption of humanity through the abolition of religion, property, and the old social order. You can't make an omelet without breaking eggs. The Bolsheviks who liquidated the kulaks in the Ukraine are said to have gone about their work often with tears in their eyes. They had convinced themselves that they were inflicting suffering for high moral purposes. It must be done, but it was painful. It was moral, a moral necessity. I am suggesting that the real conflict in our age is between opposed types of imagination, or to speak more accurately, among a variety of types of imagination. There is the idyllic imagination of Rousseau, the diabolic imagination of Sade, the leveling imagination of Marx, the moral imagination of Burke, the animal farm imagination of the hedonists, and other species might be distinguished. The wicked words written on the sky are not in one tongue merely. We may perceive there competing the moral illusions of the fanatic ideologue, the bleary-eyed voluptuary, and the militant atheist. So the great contest in these declining years of the 20th century is not for human economic interests, or for human political preferences, or even for human minds, not at bottom. The true battle is being fought in the debatable land of the human imagination. Imagination does rule the world. Yet most people are aware of this imaginative competition only vaguely or not at all. Everyone present today is probably familiar with the mentality that derides or detests imagination to that mentality's own bane. Nothing actually is more impractical than pure doctrinaire practicality. So it is with people who fancy that the world's discords may be harmonized by mere economic formulas or by public elections. I am all in favor of the dissemination of sound economic understanding. I have written myself, with much aid from Professor Peterson here at the table in front of me, a high school textbook in economics. Professor Campbell, I should say. But I am amused by the free enterprise films, for example, often shown by industrial and commercial firms to captive audiences of employees or of school children. Films that laud especially the methods and products of the film sponsor. As old Thomas Fuller puts it, a mother-in-law's sermons seldom sit well with an audience of daughter-in-laws. If the dismal science is to be taught effectively, abstract precept and platitude will not suffice. I know Dr. William Campbell here agrees with me on that. It must be taught with imagination, including the employment of symbols, allegories, fables, literary illustrations, and appeals to the moral understanding. It is important to grasp the idea of supply and demand, the laws of supply and demand. It is still more important to grasp the principles of justice. The delusion that right reason will prevail through popular elections is still more widely entertained, despite the recent failures of that theory in lands so diverse as Vietnam, Zimbabwe, and El Salvador. Many persons of large means in this land of liberty continue to fancy that winning a national election or a state election or a local election or even a school board election somehow will of itself set right the condition that was out of joint. Therefore, huge sums are poured into the present Democratic primary contests, an ordeal from which Republican contributors of money mercifully are spared in 1984. I don't imply that elections make no difference. I mean that they don't make a great enduring difference. The real decision is not at the polls, but in the people's long-run imagination. For conservatives especially, a successful election is at best a kind of holding operation, temporarily preventing some silly things from being accomplished, rather than securing the adoption of wise permanent measures. Some folk complain that President Reagan did not promptly abolish the welfare state right after his taking the oath of office. But Mr. Reagan himself had been perfectly aware that he would be able to accomplish nothing of that sort. He had learned that while governor of California. Politics is the art of the possible merely. The long-run decisions of the electorate are formed not by party platforms and campaign speeches, but by visions, by prejudices, if you will. Only the changing of such visions can produce large, enduring political alterations, for the better or the worse. The popular rhetoric of Franklin Roosevelt or of Ronald Reagan achieved considerable political success because it woke visions in many people's imaginations. So if we mean to resist the wicked things written on the sky, if we are to set our faces against the totalist and nihilist wave of the future, we must renew the sources of our moral imagination. I do not mean that we should repair to doctrine or ideology. On the contrary, we should abjure the narrowness of ideology and improve our liberal learning, which is something very different from today's liberal politics. Paul Elmer Moore once remarked that the able conservative statesman possesses a certain quality of imagination, which is of high service at times of crisis. That sort of imagination, and not political imagination only, American conservatives must employ if they aspire to erase the wicked things written on the sky. Now, I fear we have not made, as yet, much progress in this direction, we conservatives. I am told that one national organization intended to wake the imagination of the rising generation, the Intercollegiate Studies Institute, found itself injuriously short of funding after the victory of Ronald Reagan in 1980, and still does find itself short. Why so? Well, because well-intentioned possible benefactors of ISI fancied that the victory having been won at the polls, who needs imagination any longer? Who needs even to think? We're in power. The trouble with this reasoning is that unimaginative administrations do not remain in power. And so the time falls out of joint all over again. The journal that I helped to found, Modern Age, concerned in large part with the moral imagination, always has had hard sledding. During the past year, it had to suspend publication, although it is now being revived. The naive may suggest that surely there is plenty of money in America available from the affluent to support a serious quarterly of conservative ideas, but not at all. Modern Age and other periodicals of a conservative bent are really shoestring operations because the people who ought to be backing them are obsessed by debating points of finance and putting up funds in elections. One is surprised and pleased that in recent years such conservative publications addressed to more than immediate political and economic controversies as Chronicles of Culture and the Southern Partisan have made their appearance and achieved some influence. These are symptoms of awareness in some quarters that conservatives ought not to ignore humane letters and philosophy. Who put that writing in the sky? Who applauds it? Why, aside from radical ideologues of one sort or another, the principal offenders are what Peter Berger and Brigitte Berger call the knowledge class. The knowledge class. I quote now the Berger's description of this new middle class in the recent book, The War Over the Family. They say, put simply, these people, the knowledge class, are the people who derive their livelihood from the production, distribution, and administration of symbolic knowledge. They are not just the so-called intellectuals who may be seen as an upper crust in this new stratum. Rather, the expanding knowledge industry, as the economist Fritz Machloup first called it, contains large numbers of people who could by no reasonable criterion be called intellectuals. The vast educational system, the therapeutic helping complex, sizable portions of governmental bureaucracy, the media and publishing industries, and others. What all these have in common is that bodies of symbolic knowledge, as distinct from the knowledge of, say, the physical scientist or the marketing expert, these bodies of symbolic knowledge are to be applied to indoctrinate, they call it educate, indoctrinate, inspire, they call it help, to indoctrinate, to inspire, and plan for other people. As the Burghers mentioned, in America, this new class now numbers millions of people. It is they who aspire to run the so-called information age through the computers. They are very ready to program you and me. The chief trouble with them is that as a class, they are devoid of moral imagination and of humane learning, and they are puffed up with presumption. One thinks of Eliot's lines, "Where is the wisdom? We have lost in knowledge. Where is the knowledge? We have lost in information." Those wicked things written on the sky, those slogans that would supplant community by collectivism, character by approved social indoctrination, literature by propaganda, love by welfare, thought by conditioned response, babies by cabbage patch dolls. These things seem generally commendable to the knowledge class, for they have been crammed with certain types of information, but their imaginative powers have been left to wither. This has been a disastrous failure of American education, but the fault is mentioned only glancingly and by implication in the recent report of the National Commission on Excellence in Education. A report, otherwise, for the most part, valuable. Fencing themselves wise, the knowledge class as a body either embrace or else accept as inevitable the things that seem to be written in the sky. Their vision is either vaguely humanitarian or concerned principally with perquisites for themselves. A young woman of our acquaintance who recently involved herself successfully in computer instruction reports a conversation with representatives of this knowledge class. And they were given to ideological grumbling slogans, such as 80% of the wealth is owned by 2% of the people. And this perhaps is sufficient illustration of the actual limits of their knowledge. Our friend commented to us that these people obviously form themselves a privileged class, what with ample salaries, academic tenure, tax-exempt grants, expense-paid junkets, gophers to do their work, sabbaticals, and merely routine duties to perform. Yet they are unaware that the privileged are themselves, and they mumble self-righteously these slogans written on the sky. They vote for heart. Conceivably, we may contrive means for restoring the imagination of some members of the knowledge class, or at least the imagination of the successors to the present generation of that class. If we cannot, we had best cudgel our own imagination for ways to restrain the knowledge class. As Humpty Dumpty put it, it's a question of who's to be master, that's all. A culture dominated by that sort of knowledge, which is mere information, presently will become a dull and impoverished culture, if not something worse. It may end in bathos, though meanwhile the fortunate members of the knowledge class may have diverted themselves in perverse pleasure under those twisted trees. When the moral imagination is extinguished, those wicked things written in the sky soon take on earthly substance, and servitude to them is not mild. I thank you for hearing me out.